Hello and welcome to edition 395 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards.
On the show today, journalist and foreign affairs specialist Robin Lustig will be in the studio. He's here to discuss his storied career in news journalism as detailed in his new memoir, Is Anything Happening?
We'll also hear from Nathan Hill, author of critically lauded new novel, The Knicks, a story of intergenerational political intrigue with a healthy dose of sharp humour, Norse mythology thrown in too.
And to help celebrate Chinese New Year, we'll be joined by restaurateur and Chinese cookery expert Andrew Wong. He'll be dishing up a Sunday taster at the end of the show, Andrew.
And that's all to come, plus Monocle's smoothly whiskered, de-whiskered rather, Henry Rhys Sheridan will be serving up an extravagant helping of next week's news. And we'll play some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Another week bites the dust, Andrew, and we stand very much here at Midori House on the precipice.
Not the precipice, that's a very well-chosen word.
Yeah, maybe I should have picked that better. But a big week gone, bigger week ahead.
Yeah, so we're gearing up for the 10th anniversary of Monocle. We're just a few weeks away. It was a March issue that came out in mid-February, all the way back in 2007. And we can do a slight retweak of the format and the look of the magazine.
That could be. Is that what? Does that count as a world exclusive? It's in the ballpark.
I think we've hinted elsewhere, but yes, it's well underway.
And all will relatively soon be revealed.
Well, it's just a very strange process. It's something you've done for 10 years. You then go back and quiz everything again, and you ask yourself lots of questions. And lots of things have come through that kind of test unscathed. And other things we've felt, actually, times have changed, you know, our readership is broader and bigger and is interested in other things, and we need to reflect that. So it's very, very exciting and also a little bit tense-making.
That aside, though, what about the last 7 days? Smooth sailing, then. You've been strolling down Easy Street.
I'm not sure where you've been following me. That was not Easy Street I was waddling down. No, it's all good. Between you and me, I hate this time of year. It's
really?
Too dark. Post-Christmas.
It's dark. It's been as brisk as you like, hasn't it, this past week? Chilly around the old turntables. That's what my elderly white-haired grandfather used to say.
Very, very chilly around the turntables. Turntables? Turnstiles?
Turntables? I don't know. I never knew what he was on about half the time. Speaking of which, should we hear from human cubal hybrid Henry Rhys Sheridan?
Let's bring him in.
Human cue ball hybrid.
That's right. You look like a little cue ball stuck on the end of a cocktail stick.
Now, we should point out to our listeners that you're normally quite whiskery, and now you've gone smooth.
Without further ado, I'm going to begin my news look ahead.
We're only bitter that you look so young. It's irritating.
Thanks very much, Andrew. I'll take that as a compliment.
It was.
On the 2nd of February, the US National Prayer Breakfast is taking place in Washington. Are you familiar with this event?
No.
No. It is an event that is in its 64th year this year. And every single president since Eisenhower has spoken at it. Basically, it is an event which does encompass a breakfast, but also other functions. Tom, I know that you would like that to be clarified from the outset. Organised by a slightly vaguely shadowy Christian organisation called the Fellowship Foundation. And its stated aim is to unite people from all walks of life and religious backgrounds under the name of Jesus. Now, I'm very interested in these kinds of organisations, events that manage to basically compel very, very, very powerful people to go to them for not a particularly good reason stated in their mission statement. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Exactly.
I'm fascinated also as to how Donald Trump is going to present himself here. He tends not to do so well. We all remember from during the campaign trail his appearance at that roast. When he's in a room of, shall we say, mixed allegiances, he does find it quite difficult to work the room. So it should be fun viewing for all.
And I wonder what they get for breakfast. I mean, that would be your first question, Tom.
Yeah. What kind of breakfast is it? I mean, for example, if it's more of a continental breakfast, I'd probably be nixing it.
You'd skip it. If you were the president of the United States of America,
I'd need to know that there was, you know, a full hash browns, all that kind of caper. A stack of pancakes may be involved.
Sure, maple syrup.
Ted Woods doesn't get out of bed for a low-fat yogurt.
No. I mean, do you enjoy the American high-calorie breakfast?
Look at me, Henry.
No, I know. I mean, I imagine
there's
you
nothing
would,
of you. That's the other irritating thing.
No, but that's the high metabolism.
We'll have the pancakes over here for Tom and the low-fat yogurt. That's for Mr. Trump.
Exactly. Plate of mashed yeast for Donald.
So let's move on. On the 31st of January, US composer Philip Glass is celebrating his 80th birthday. The Barbican has had a series of events here in London celebrating it all over the weekend. I was introduced to the work of Glass very young because my dad...
was a glazer.
...used to... He's not.
Oh, that's good.
My dad used to play his very repetitive records in the car while we used to drive over the Severn Bridge from Wales to England and back again. I used to hate it, but I've grown to, in my mature snobbery, embrace it. So
I like Philip Glass.
Yeah.
But I would imagine with kids in the car, hey, kids, let's have a sing-along as we head over the Severn Bridge.
He wasn't very good at gauging what kind of music would most appeal to, for example, a 5 to 12-year-old. So good to have you still here at 80. Yeah, Philip would be my birthday message.
But I hear that not many people have been going to the concerts. There have been a glass half full.
That is even better. He's absolutely nailed it.
And glass I can't follow that.
That is top. Look how pleased Andrew is with that as well. That could be a career. You may just have to bow out now, Andrew. I'm not sure you. Come on.
Before the 10th anniversary.
Can you follow that, Henry? I'm assuming you can't.
I can't follow it, but I can. I mean, I will end on a physically active note. On the 1st of February, the annual Empire State Building run-up.
Oh, this is good.
Okay, go, because I know you're a marathon runner, formerly.
3 years ago.
Formerly. Yeah. Tell me about this event, Tom.
It is what it is. You start at the bottom, it's a race to the top of the Empire State Building, up all... How many steps is it? 3,000?
No, not quite. So it's 1,575. But that's a lot, because you know when you're
in the tube... It doesn't sound like that much, I mean, that's a lot.
You know when you're in the tube and it's like, warning... It's 129 steps or whatever. Don't use, you know, unless it's an emergency, you're meant to use the lift. And you always think, I can handle it. But by halfway up, you're knackered. You know, that's a lot of stairs.
Youngster like yourself should be flying up there.
But I'm normally okay.
Have you got any details about the record, for example?
Unfortunately, not. I can tell you that it's been held annually since 1978.
I think the record is something around 3 minutes.
3 minutes, do you say?
I think so.
3 minutes vertically up 86 floors.
Yeah.
That is impressive.
They don't hang around in the Big Apple.
If you're in New York on 1st of February, I'm sure all the registration details are online.
Thank you very much for joining us, Henry.
Thank you very much.
Robin Lustig is a regular voice here on Monocle 24 and will also be familiar to listeners of the BBC, presenting flagship shows in the past such as The World Tonight.
He's reported from over 80 countries, was in Moscow for the final day of the Soviet Union's demise and was in Berlin on the day the country was reunified. Robin's also interviewed leaders ranging from Nelson Mandela to Kofi Annan and Tony Blair. He's even been shot at while reporting from Pakistan.
There's enough for a good book there, surely. And luckily, Robin has now written his memoir, Is Anything Happening? My Life as a Newsman. And he joins us now in the studio to discuss it. Robin, welcome to the show. I know we're going to dive in, I'm sure, to lots of topics around the nature of reporting these days. But it's great going back to the beginning of your book, where you point out that you were literally one of those people out in the field, the Reuters man, waiting for people to phone you up and ask that simple question, is anything happening?
Yeah, they did. I mean, it does seem like a different world. I almost sometimes think that I must have started at about the time that the dinosaurs died out. I mean, it was before the internet. It was before mobile telephones. It was before 24-hour news channels. And if you were a newspaper foreign correspondent overseas, then the only way you could find out what was going on in the world if you'd been out of touch for a few hours was to phone the local Reuters bureau and say, hey, Robin, is anything happening? Because the Reuters people kept the bureau staffed all day, every day. So they were the ones who did know what was happening. These days, of course, all you need to do is look at Twitter and you've got it. But it was very different. I mean, we're talking about, well, over 45 years ago, which is when I started.
You say we just look at Twitter and we've got it. You know, my career isn't quite as long as yours, but I certainly started in a time pre-internet. Do you think you do just look at Twitter and you've got it these days? Because what's interesting, I guess, you know, there's a yawning gap between not having enough information and having too much information. But I think often we look back at those times and think, first of all, there was the notion of contemplation before you sent something off, or you were able to craft things a little bit more. And now, even if we look at the likes of the New York Times or the Washington Post just this week, trying to cope with the number of news lines out of any story. I had breakfast with someone this morning, as an aside, who is a very intelligent person, said, I have stopped looking at all of my news sources because I cannot cope.
I understand that. I mean, you're right, of course. It is a double-edged sword. I start from the proposition that if more people have more access to more information, that's a good thing. The problem arises then in trying to filter that information, trying to sort out what's true from what's not true, trying to sort out what's important from what's not important, and trying to make sense of it all. I mean, I think that's the real problem that people have now. There is this deluge of information which sort of overwhelms people. And I think a lot of people do feel very tempted to turn off. I think that's very dangerous. I think if people start turning off and saying, I can't cope, I'm not interested anymore, then we're in a very bad place. But I wake up in the morning and the first thing I do is look at my mobile phone and look at my Twitter. And I will know within a couple of minutes all the important things that have happened in the world. I don't need a newspaper. I don't even need to turn on my radio. It is all there instantly. For a journalist, that's wonderful.
What about the, I guess, editorial prism? Because we're talking about, you know, an old school newsman and the training that you go through, and there'd be influential editors who teach you the art of refining information for yourself. Isn't there a risk with this that it becomes an unfiltered prism? And people think, you know, if we look at, say, what's happening stateside at the moment, the narrative in news is what is even a fact or not? And then you get into alternative facts and post-truths and all those new cliches. But, I mean, that's a worry, isn't it? If it becomes fully citizen journalism, then there aren't any citizen editors and we don't get the refinement that everybody probably needs.
No, you're right. You're right. Of course you're right. But we are still in a state of transition, it seems to me. Because the technology has moved so fast, there is now an absence of filters, and I think people have not yet learnt how to apply their own filters or how to find other filters. I use a lot of aggregate news sites, which are a kind of first division filter. Somebody somewhere, an editor who is paid to edit, is saying to me, here are the things which we think you might be interested in looking at, and we can vouch for their credibility. That's fine. We now know, because of recent revelations, that the search engines who claimed to have algorithms which helped to filter things by credibility don't really do that in the way that they gave us the impression that they did. So that is something to be aware of. But yeah, I mean, of course, there is a lot of information out there that is rubbish. There is a lot of information out there that is grossly misleading. This whole sort of alternative fact thing, we have to be a little bit careful about. It's not all that new. I mean, Winston Churchill used a great phrase once. He used to talk about terminological inexactitudes. Well, that's an alternative fact, but just using more syllables. I mean, politicians have always dissembled. It's part of what being a politician is about. What I think is new now that we're seeing come out of Washington in particular is a denial of objectively observed facts. You can count a crowd size. You can spot when rain stops falling. When you have a head of state saying, it didn't happen like that because I didn't want it to happen like that, then we're in a slightly new game.
Mm-hmm. And it's part of the brazenness as well. Is that new? I mean, you cite someone like Winston Churchill who charmed even with his inexactitudes. That's worrying as well,
the pretense
isn't
it? Has gone, hasn't it? I mean, you could argue that perhaps it's more honest the way it's done now. I mean, I said politicians dissemble and that's part of what they do. if one wants to be charitable, they do it in a good cause because they believe it enables them then to enact the policies which they wish to enact. I mean, we're talking about Donald Trump. Let's not beat about the bush. I think what makes Donald Trump different is that he seems to have a kind of mental state which renders him incapable of accepting facts that everybody else knows to be true.
Robin, you had an amazing career out in the field, but also perhaps many British people hearing your voice, you know, certainly makes me think I should be going to bed soon when I hear your voice.
10 o'clock at night, yeah. The world's at night. Good night.
So associated. You got to, for my generation, for many other people, for many, many years, tell us the stories that were shaping our lives, whether that was, you know, the death of Princess Diana and Dodi Al-Fayed, whether that was 9/11. In the end, did you think that your skill set or your moment was best telling those stories and pulling in all the threads from all the people around the world, or being out there on the road?
My preference always was to be out there on the road. To me, being a reporter, being a journalist, is about seeing for yourself, finding out what's going on, and then telling everybody else about it. Sitting in a studio, for me, had other benefits, but it was always second best. I mean, there is one advantage sometimes to not being on the spot. There are a couple of instances that I tell in the book when I was on the spot, but I still didn't get the story. I mean, the very first story I ever covered, which was a hijack by a Palestinian group, and one of them was being kept in a London police station for several days. I was outside that London police station for several days waiting for the hijacker to be released. When she was released, I didn't even notice because she was smuggled out in a police car. I wasn't on my own, I should say. None of the reporters there knew. After 9/11, I wasn't in New York. I was here in London. And I think in some ways it was better to be in London because it enabled me to have an overview of what was going on. There are horses for courses. Sometimes it is absolutely right to be on the ground. I've always remembered something that a reporter said to me. He was covering the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and he was one of those embedded reporters going in with the US troops. And I was interviewing him from a BBC studio, and he said to me, you know, the problem I have is that I'm watching this war as if through a letterbox. I can see exactly what's in front of my eyes, but I can't relate it to anything else that's going on. I don't know what's going on behind me. I don't know what's going on to either side of me. I certainly don't know what's going on 50 or 100 miles away. And it was me sitting in the studio who was able to tell him what the bigger picture was. He could just see that tiny fraction. You need both, of course. You need somebody in the studio with the overview, and you need somebody on the ground telling you what's happening in front of his eyes.
Robin, what happens, you mentioned this idea about being on the road. Does that mean that you are, I don't know, you sort of frustrated day to day? Do you sometimes get a bit of wanderlust comes back and
always.
You just head off? How do you deal with that when that sets in?
I used to say, I mean, I'm older and wiser now, but I used to say that I was never really happy unless I had an airline booking sitting on my desk and I knew when my next trip would be. I love travelling. I love going to new places. And even after having left the BBC, I have still done quite a lot of reporting for other organisations. And I've been to countries, Democratic Republic of Congo, Sierra Leone, South Sudan, Burma, Myanmar, countries that I hadn't visited before that I'd wanted to visit. So there are still opportunities. I'm slowly having to get used to the idea that just occasionally I'll have to pay my own airfare, which is, comes a bit of a shock. I mean, one of the great things about the career that I've had is that for most of my adult life, somebody else paid for me to travel.
Robin, throughout the story, you go into a few byways to dwell every now and then in a really wonderful way about your family's history and how that has kind of shaped in part your career as a newsreader and as a journalist as well. Your parents came here in 1939 after Kristallnacht. Your father was a promising musician who came here ostensibly to train as a builder and ended up here. How much did that story of your parents' lives as migrants, you point out, you know, that you worked with many people at the BBC, for example, who had had a Cambridge, you know, education, who had had a lot of luck in their birth, and you kind of just needed luck along the way.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was to make the point that being a journalist isn't only about having parents who were journalists, going to the right private school, going to Oxford or Cambridge University, because that seems to be the impression more and more that people have, that it's a very privileged occupation. And if you look at the statistics, it does seem to be so. I was quite shocked when I arrived at the BBC, having been a journalist for 20 years by then, that everybody assumed I'd been to Oxford or Cambridge. And I hadn't. I went to the University of Sussex, and I'm very proud of having gone to the University of Sussex. But, I mean, my parents' background did colour a lot of what I did. I think part of it was that I wanted always to see people who were having a difficult time because I could somehow relate to them, because my own parents had had a difficult time. Also, at a time when refugees are so much in the public eye and there is so much critical coverage of the drain that refugees are on the public purse, on the negative impact that they have on society, you know, I'm the son of refugees.
And also, as your book points out, your parents, with, you know, they helped the war effort. They were directly involved. And that's what we forget about refugees. Yeah. Too often, their narratives very quickly become our narratives.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I say at one point in the book that when I watch TV coverage of refugees coming out of Africa or coming out of Syria or of Afghanistan, I sort of see my parents' faces there. It could have been them. And I look at the young children who come with them and I think, one day, who knows, they might be broadcasters, they might be journalists, we don't know. And it's something that is actually quite important to me, that people learn to see refugees through a different lens. And if I can help them do that, then so much the better.
Can I just ask a quick follow-up on that before I let Tom back in? The interesting thing about identity, you know, we have all these questions arising at the moment. You know, do young Muslim people feel British, or are they going back to their roots? You know, this was a time, the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, when whoever seemed to have arrived here was expected to assimilate very quickly, often drop their family names and become part of, you know, the very kind of mainstream community. It's interesting, you say that one of your chapter headings is, I think, are you Jewish?
Yeah.
And you say that your wife says to you at one point, you only realised you were Jewish when you met me. Has that identity of being Jewish become more important to you with the passing of time?
No, but the question has become more interesting. I do find the whole issue of identity very interesting indeed. I don't think of myself as Jewish. I didn't have a Jewish upbringing. I got married in a synagogue because my wife is Jewish, and it's something that was very important to her father at the time. It is not something that has been important to me. It was something that wasn't important to my parents either, or indeed in my father's case, even to his parents. There is such a thing as an assimilated Jewish identity. And if it hadn't been for the fact that I'd married a Jewish woman and had then gone as a Middle East correspondent to live in Israel for 3 years, where almost every day I was asked that question. That's why I made it the chapter heading. I'd never once been asked that question until I moved to Israel. I'd never asked it of myself. A rabbi had asked me when we wanted to get married in a synagogue. He said, look, I mean, it's fine. I'm very happy to marry you, but you are going to have to be Jewish and you're going to have to prove that you're Jewish. So I said, well, how do I do that? He said, well, all I need to know is that your mother is Jewish. I said, well, how do I prove that? He said, bring me a piece of paper that says to me that she was Jewish. She was still alive at that time, so I was able to go to her and say, Mum, do you have any piece of paper that says you're Jewish? She said, well, I think I might have. Went into a desk drawer and pulled out an old German passport issued by the Nazis. What did it have on it? A great big J. J for Jew. And that was it. Because of a Nazi document, I was Jewish, I could get married in a synagogue. It's absurd. But, you know, it comes back to identity. Who are we? You ask me what I am, I'd say I'm a reporter, long before I would say I was Jewish.
Well, I want to ask, just one very tiny question. What's it like keeping Nelson Mandela waiting?
Oh, that was painful. I mean, Nelson Mandela was the one interview I did which I think it really did have me quite seriously stressed. And he was already very elderly by the time I got to meet him, and he was renowned for being a stickler for timekeeping and not like being messed about. and I failed on the timekeeping, and I messed him about because the interview that we recorded with him had to be recorded in London, not in Johannesburg, and there was a satellite link that failed, and I had to sit there making small talk for 20 very long minutes with Mr. Mandela being incredibly gracious and very charming, but nevertheless making no secret of the fact that the clock was going tick-tock in a different way, and he didn't have a lot of time, and yeah, I was stressed.
Good. Well, I hope we haven't stressed you today.
Oh, this has been a pleasure.
Good stuff. Well, people can read more of Robin's account. Is Anything Happening? My Life as a Newsman by Robin Lustig is out in, I'm presuming, all good bookshops now, Robin?
All good bookshops and even some bad ones, I suspect.
Okay, get involved with it. Robin, thanks for coming to see us.
Thank you.
Andrew, how about a musical interlude?
I'm coming with you.
It's time for a tune. This is the first new one in 3 years from American jangle pop peddlers Real Estate. Here they are. This is Darling.
Real Estate from New Jersey with Darling.
Yes.
We'll be
Andrew.
We'll be hearing from author Nathan Hill in a moment. The US author Nathan Hill's debut novel is The Knicks. It tells the story of a mother and son reluctantly reunited after 20 years of separation, where mum decides to physically attack a presidential hopeful. A swaggering, flamboyant, right-wing one at that.
Laced with a postmodern sensibility and no small helping of wit, the book's title actually comes from Scandinavian mythology, the Nyx, being a supernatural spirit capable of bringing both good and bad fortune upon a person in equal measure. It's already been picked up for a TV series by J.J. Abrams and Meryl Streep, no less, and the book has had praise steeped on it by such writers as John Irving and Stephen King. Well, Monocle's Tom Hall was joined by Nathan Hill a little earlier to learn more about it.
At its heart, it's a mother-son story. It's a story of a mom, Faye, and her son, Samuel. And Faye unexpectedly leaves the family when Samuel is 11 years old, and he doesn't see her again for 20 years. When he does see her again, she's sort of injected into his life in an unexpected way. She's on the news throwing rocks at a far-right presidential candidate. And so he decides that he needs to get back into her life and figure out not only why she's committing this ridiculous crime, but also where she was all of this time and why she left the family when she did.
It's incredibly timely that we have this slightly far-right presidential candidate who's one of the main kind of concerns in the book. Was any of that apparent to you as you were writing it? I mean, I know you've been writing this book for a very long time, so you can't have been seeing so precisely into the future to know that it would be published around this time. Or did you have a bit of a feeling? Did you have a feeling that there are these figures in politics and it's not a leap of the imagination to imagine a story of this kind arising?
I wrote that character, that particular far-right presidential candidate, I wrote that character 8 years ago. And as I was touring in the States last fall, everybody kept asking, oh, you must have written that with this year's political silly season in mind. And the truth is, I didn't. It's just that that reality eclipsed fiction very, very quickly and, in fact, became even more absurd. I wrote that character just to be funny, honestly, and that it ends up being kind of prescient is a little horrifying.
Yeah, this is Governor Packer mm-hmm. in the book, and one of the book's characters, Samuel's mother, Faye, is sort of christened by the media as the Packer attacker.
Yeah.
And that obviously speaks to the way the media, it loves a moniker, it loves a meme. Were you trying to tackle any of those themes when you wrote the book about sort of media consumption and also the way people lead their lives? Because there's also some sort of parallel themes in the book about kind of online addiction and people sort of being drawn away from, I guess, societal norms into little bubbles. Were you sort of trying to highlight a bit of that in the telling of this story?
I was. The the headline that appears once Faye attacks Governor Packer in chapter one, the headline that appears is something like, 60s radical hippie attacks Governor Packer. And the story that crystallizes on that first day is that she's a far leftist and she waited to attack the governor because she hates his political views. And that's just that very quick explanation hardens, and that's just what everybody believes. And then the work of the next few hundred pages is to undo that. And I was very conscious about that, that it's very easy for us, especially when we're online a lot and we're getting a lot of headlines, it's very, very easy and seductive to look at a headline, give that topic maybe 15 seconds of consideration, and then render a verdict in our heads, you know, thumbs up or thumbs down. You know, I notice myself doing this all the time, and it's I think it requires a real act of mental resistance to stop and think about it a little bit more and maybe investigate a little beneath the headline. And so I think if there's any argument that the book is making is that these stories are really puzzles that need to be solved.
One of the great things about the book is it opens at this, it's not like a breakneck clip, but it drops you straight into a very kind of, not necessarily like a fast moving, not an alien situation, and it's not a shocking situation. It's more, it felt to me like a very engaging book immediately, because it felt to me similar to the way you would like turn on a TV midway through something. I mean, that is how the book starts, so I'm kind of, that was planted in my brain. But it has this kind of tone to it that's very unpretentious, and there's a lot of humour mixed in there too. And I read in an interview you saying that when you started to write it, you were trying to write this like quite heavy, huge sort of political polemic. And then you realized that, well, you used a great quote. You just said that's rude, because because like you need to like give people a laugh and you need to give people some light in there. Your writing style, how did you evolve that humor into it? Was that something that you can only pick up over time, where you develop a sense of humor about maybe some really serious things that happen over time in your life? Is that where that comes from?
I worked on this book for a really long time. I began in 2004. I was a young man, very politically aggressive, and I thought I had all the answers. And thank goodness I came to a very basic epiphany somewhere along the way, which is that, what are the odds that from my very limited point of view, I knew like the capital T truth about American politics. So yeah, instead I kind of loosened up a little bit, and instead of trying to be sanctimonious about it, I started writing about kind of what it feels like, kind of on your nerve endings, to be living through certain political moments, to kind of brush up against political movements, what that feels like. And yeah, the humor came a little bit later in the writing process, because, you know, I was working on this book for many years, and honestly, there was no guarantee that it was going to get published. There was no guarantee that it was going to anybody would ever read it. So I decided somewhere along the way that if I'm going to be working on this for 10 years, it better be worth it, just to do it every day. And I guess that's probably where the humor came from. That's a lot of the times what brings me joy in the morning is just trying to like find those moments of just absurdity in the culture and tweak them a little bit and have some fun with them. And so I think the humor in the book came from that, just me having a good time and being playful while I was writing.
And the central character in the book, it's a college professor, and you have lived that life yourself. And one of the things that I found really refreshing about the book is this, as I said, unpretentiousness about some of the attitudes towards academia. There's a lot of talk in the beginning about his pupils just basically thinking Hamlet is bullshit, which is, you know, that's a very sort of broad stroke for people to take, but it is something also that you can empathize with in this. As you say, people can barely focus on a headline for more than 15 seconds. Mm-hmm. It's like, how can you actually really expect them to digest this stuff properly anymore? But I guess also you are a scholar and you do love all that amazing writing. And how do you balance that juxtaposition between knowing that these are fantastic works to be respected and to be enjoyed and to be delved into deeply, and then also trying to just keep students interested in that? I mean, I feel like that was maybe written from a very real perspective in your life. Is that something you've experienced, trying
Definitely.
To keep people engaged?
Yeah, I used to teach creative writing classes, but also I taught first year writing classes, just literature classes that are required courses for everybody who goes to the school. And imagine like teaching someone who's majoring in finance, whose big goal is to go make a lot of money, why they should be reading poetry.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Imagine that can be very tricky. And in some ways, you have to meet them on their level, you know, and think about, what does this do for you? How is it utilitarian? You know, and yeah. and I think it is. I think reading literature kind of opens you up to experience. It helps with your empathy muscles. It helps you understand where other people are coming from. There's actually this great study that came out, I want to say in 2008 or 2009, but the headline in the New York Times was something like, if you want to succeed in a job interview, go read more Chekhov.
Wow.
And it was this study where these neurobiologists really did see that the more good literature people read, the better they are at like office politics, you know? So when I would teach these students, I would try to get them to see the actual real life benefits. But for me, it's more like I love being in a world. I love drowning in good sentences, but I couldn't hope that my finance students would just see the beauty like I do. And it wasn't a good enough argument, just that it was pretty. I had to go a little further than that.
There's an amazing line about the sort of reluctance of both parties, I guess, like both student and teacher in that situation, where you said something like, if he hadn't assigned them something so stupid, they wouldn't have had to not do it. Like, just absolute stalemate. I wanted to talk about some of the praise that's been heaped on the book. People like Stephen King and John Irving, and people have also called it a Dickensian tale. I mean, you must be absolutely over the moon with those kind of plaudits coming in for the book. Is that something that you had any inkling that would be coming in as you were writing this?
Well, first of all, like, you know, nobody knows who I am. And so in some ways you have to do that. You know, if you like this author, you might like Nathan Hill. So I, you know, because I'm a stranger to everybody, those kinds of comparisons are sort of necessary. But yeah, I mean, you know, John Irving is a very early hero of mine, and he's been an amazing champion for the book. So that's been all really unexpected and really delightful. You know, like I was working in total obscurity, writing a very long book that's very difficult to summarize in an elevator pitch. And so I thought, nobody's ever going to read this thing. So the fact that it's been getting some attention and people have been saying really nice things is just a surprise and a delight.
And the book is now being made into a TV series with J.J. Abrams and Meryl Streep. That's incredibly exciting, isn't it?
It is, yeah. The just wattage of the team behind the TV show is unbelievable. Meryl Streep, J.J. Abrams, John Logan. It's in very, very good hands. Hollywood started becoming interested in the book when it came out in the States. And I was a little nervous about it. You know, I'd worked on this thing for 10 years. It's my baby. And I kind of didn't want to give it to anybody. And then the first person who wanted it was Meryl Streep. And I was like, oh, good. That's problem solved. It's going to be fine.
The book is, I guess it's like a more human approach to how ordinary people find themselves involved and embroiled in political situations. We're seeing lots of marches across the USA now. Do you feel that sense back home when you're there that, you know, this is something that people should all be taking an interest in and getting involved in and trying to voice their opinion more in the US political arena?
I think people should voice their political opinions in the way that feels right for them. And that sometimes takes the form of protest, and sometimes takes the form of quiet thoughtfulness at home. And I think that should be okay. I tend to be slow on these things. I tend to like really gather information and think for a long time. So I'm not a big, you know, I don't express many opinions on Twitter other than thanking people who have read the book.
Yeah.
Because I reserve the right to be wrong a lot. And I know I've been wrong a lot. And so, but I thought the Women's March was extraordinary. And it was a nice signal, I think, to the rest of the world that the majority of people didn't actually choose this.
This book, it also, we'll go into this briefly because I don't want to open up the entire sort of mythological canon of Norse mythology, but the Nyx, its title, kind of refers to this spirit-like entity that can sort of sit on your shoulder for good or bad, and it comes from the character's Norwegian lineage. Where did you stumble on that? Is that something personal to your life, or is that something that you've had an interest in for a while? What was the motive for getting that into the book?
Yeah, and you're right. I do have to explain to people that it's not a basketball novel. It's spelled N-I-X. And yeah, it's a Norwegian story, and my family on my mother's side came to the States from Norway several generations ago. We've since lost all contact with relatives back there, but I knew that it was part of my history. So when I encountered these Norwegian folktales later in life, they kind of stuck because I knew they were a part of me. The Nyx specifically is a story from Scandinavian folklore. He's usually depicted as a water troll that kind of hides just beneath the surface of a pond. But he's also a shapeshifter, and he will appear to children sometimes as a beautiful white horse and try to tempt the children to climb aboard. And if they do, he will run them into the water and drown them. and I guess it's kind of a story about, like, sometimes something that seems amazing ends up hurting you the worst, you know, and so that kind of became the moral of the story for me, because a lot of the characters in the Knicks are undermined by the very things that mean the most to them. The things that they love the most end up hurting them the worst.
That was our Tom Hall speaking to Nathan Hill there about his book The Knicks, which is out now. And we'll be doing some Chinese cooking after this.
The year of the rooster has begun, Andrew. Yesterday saw the start of Chinese New Year, and to celebrate, we're ending this show with a look at Chinese culture and cooking. My favourite.
I thought you were going to tell you what was your favourite.
Oh, no,
you
had a favourite just, dish. Just generally Chinese food.
Good, in general. Well, Chef Andrew Wong has been revitalising Chinese cookery in the UK. His restaurant, A. Wong, has been picking up rave reviews too. And he joins us now in the kitchen, where we're going to head now, Tom, to find out a little bit more about China and also, of course, Chinese New Year.
Let's head out there.
So, Andrew, maybe I can just clear up something first as you run around the kitchen. So your family's background was in the restaurant trade, but you'd been trying to go off in a different direction?
Yeah, any direction except the restaurant direction. Yeah, that was genuinely the plan. You know, that was the motivation for studying when we were young. Like, if you study harder, you won't have to work in a restaurant.
But tell me a little bit about your approach then to being a restaurateur now. Do you sort of look back with hindsight and say, actually, that kind of family grounding, it is the perfect way to learn, to understand what makes great food, because food is social, because food's about family. Do you sort of appreciate that, I don't know, maybe that it was always inevitable that you sort of end up doing that in a way?
Maybe. I think the things that you discuss definitely give you a grounding on hospitality. Mm. And actually, the one thing about a restaurant is it's not necessarily just about food. It's the whole package of hospitality. Food is obviously part of that. But my wife, who runs the front of house, obviously does the other half of that. And you know, sharing, generosity, and kind of making people happy. That's the kind of environment I grew up in. So my father and my mother, like, extremely generous. So people come in, cooking for them, looking after them. That was always the priority. And that's the environment I grew up with, so I never knew any different. And feeding, obviously, is a massive thing in any Chinese culture. From my perspective, eating together, it was always a treasured thing because my parents were in the industry, so they would eat very late, work very long hours. So when we did actually get to sit down together, such as Chinese New Year, it was always a treasured moment.
Were your parents pleased when they heard you were going to open a restaurant?
No, absolutely. They're disgusted. No. I initially got into the industry because my father passed away while I was at university. So I initially got into the industry to help my mum. With most undergraduates, you know, especially nowadays, 99% of them don't have a clue what they want to do anyway. And I'm one of the lucky few, actually, who fell into something that I love to do. And that's a blessing, you know.
And also just tell us, you know, the restaurant, you should describe it for people because it's not based on a typical Chinese restaurant. You've got wishbone chairs, you've got a nice sensibility about your design. You've deliberately chosen to kind of create something that doesn't look as how many people might expect a Chinese restaurant to look.
I think so. I think when we opened, anyway, at that point in time, there was a very, very specific kind of stereotypical look of what a restaurant that was attempting to cook any type of fine dining Chinese food, or what it was meant to look like. A lot of the time, that would be a look of a Chinese brothel from the 1960s. Number one, we didn't have enough cash to do that. And number two, what me and my wife really wanted to do, we really wanted the food to be the centerpiece of the restaurant. So all the furniture and all the decoration around the restaurant was always meant to be kind of a very natural, very kind of organic kind of setting for the food. I remember someone wrote an article calling our decors Scandi functional, but I don't think it was meant to be that bad. Like, I never found
it. I think
it.
That's a compliment.
is it a compliment? I don't know. Scandi functional.
What resonates with me is, you know, you talk about putting the food front and centre, and that's what we're doing here. We're lucky enough. You're rustling something up for us in our Monocle kitchen. Just tell us. I'm sure people can hear a good bit of sizzling happening. Yeah. So tell us a bit more about what you've got going on here.
So what we're doing, we're pan frying, we're searing off some beef. I think the important thing about this dish is exploring the area of China that it comes from. So it comes from a particular part of the area of China which is called Yunnan, so it borders Vietnam. And so when you have a preconception of what you think Chinese food is, you don't necessarily think of, number one, seared meat, number two, lemongrass, citrus flavours, mint flavours. You normally associate them more with kind of Vietnamese or even Malay foods, rather, but not necessarily with Chinese food. So it's interesting to explore this particular area of China through this dish.
Now, you were telling us earlier on that the dishes that have ended up on your menu are not all from one region, that you're not trying to be too purist about it. You take some techniques from elsewhere as well. How would you say you found the recipes that have actually ended up on your menu then?
Well, exploring Chinese recipes has been important, but authenticity with regards to technique, actually, that is quite important to us, actually. And I always tell people that we may add garnishes, we may add textures, we might present dishes slightly differently, but always the base flavour of every dish is the authentic recipe of the place that I learnt to cook it. And it's meant to be a little thank you to the person who taught me to cook that particular thing. For example, this dish, you know, we might mess around the garnishes, but the base flavour for the stock that we're using here for the sauce, that's 100% not been changed at all. We have a lot of other dishes that traditionally you might be presented in a more home style kind of way. You know, the stock again would be 100% exactly the same the way that I was taught in any particular region, but we would just dress it up a little bit differently.
And Andrew, we're talking around Chinese New Year as well, obviously. I wonder, is that very different? We often talk about people who are, you know, heading home for Chinese New Year, this kind of thing. Does it mean a completely different set of menu options? You know, is there a load of very specific dishes that people enjoy at this time of year? Or is it more about kind of old family favourites and sticking to the tried and tested?
The most important thing about Chinese New Year for people in China is getting home. So if you ever try to get an inland flight in China at this time of year, normally you'll be paying about 10 to 15 times the normal price. And secondly, even if you're a millionaire, unless you have a private jet, you won't be able to get a plane. So apparently it's the biggest mass migration anywhere in the world at one single moment of time. Because everyone, obviously, they go into cities to work, but they're all from rural areas. And this is the one time of year that they all flock home, bring all their presents and get together around the table to eat. And that is the most important thing for Chinese New Year. All the other things, I'm going to sound really cynical when I say this, but it always comes up to one thing. It either has to rhyme with something that brings prosperity or something that is going to make you live forever. And those are the two simple criteria for all the other...
I can work with either of those.
Exactly.
That's fine.
So anything that that we eat at Chinese New Year, it has to bring us gold or long life. That's about what it all comes down to. Spring rolls, because they resemble golden nuggets. You know, you might eat fish because it has a similar sound in Chinese to the word for abundance. Again, all of it. Getting wealthy, living forever.
And just check, by golden nuggets, you mean real gold nuggets?
Yeah,
not the chicken ones.
No. Not the golden arches.
We've given you the bluntest
can I just say,
knife.
Can I just
ever.
Say there's a wonderful moment there? Ever. I'm not sure that Andrew's going to be fully endorsing some of our kitchenware. See if this one's any better.
No,
that's a bigger knife.
You want me to rip the meat? It's okay.
Okay, we're getting through this. It turns out that the kitchen equipment at Monocle is not the sharpest knife in the drawer. It says something about us, I think, as well, Tom.
Possibly. So tell us a bit more about this dish. We've obviously got our seared beef, which is smelling amazing. What other things have we got here?
We have a sauce made up of fermented chili bean paste. Gosh, I can't believe I used the word fermented. but yeah, it's made from fermented chili bean paste, some lime, some lemongrass. And actually, if you have a general kind of stereotypical view of where you think this dish probably comes, you would say probably Vietnam or Thailand or something as a gut reaction.
Well, it's looking amazing on the plate. We've got these very thin pieces of beef cut, beautifully kind of poured over. Bit of decoration going on as well.
Yeah, I even put my tweezers. Can you believe it? It's actually because I left them in my pocket from lunch service, but I thought I might use them now. The thin, crispy things. Actually, I brought them here because they're the accompaniment when we serve it in the menu as part of the Taste of China menu. But what they are is they're a celebration of a different part of China. So a lot of people don't know this, but actually within China there's areas where rice isn't a staple carbohydrate at all. So it might be noodles, sometimes it's steamed buns. And actually they in this area called Langjiao, which is just north of Sichuan, around the center of China, They have this very, very old technique of making these noodles by hand pulling them. I don't think you've ever seen this. So they start off with one single piece of dough and they pull them and multiply them until you get really, really thin strands of dough. So that's what we do in a restaurant. And we just basically pull the noodles and then we deep fry them. And then we just serve them here with just a few extra flavors.
Now, we've got you plate up here. Maybe, Tom, you should grab a fork or something. Is it ready for Tom to try?
Yeah, go ahead.
Can I grab a fork? Is that okay?
You go for the forks, and I'll just quiz you a little bit, Andrew, about running a restaurant. So you have this space now. It's had amazing reviews. Did you realise, as you put it together, you were onto something that had the right mix, the right formula? Because you're not far from the centre of town. You're in Victoria. But it's really kind of taken off, and lots of people I've spoken to saying you were coming in today said, oh my God, I went there, went with my dad, or been with the family, an amazing, amazing experience. How quickly did you know that you'd done it right?
It's funny, I was actually just speaking to someone saying that I don't count the first month of opening as actually our opening time because it was such a disaster. but I think that the single thing that I hold on to is the fact that when me and Natalie decided to close my parents' restaurant, which they'd had since 1985, and reopen it in this form with this menu, it was never about the bottom line and it was never about making money. It was about creating a restaurant that we were going to be proud of, serving food that we would like to eat on a regular basis. And I think if you go
Speaking of which...
Tom's going in, he's had the beef, and...
Mm. Oh, that's delicious.
So how spicy?
It's definitely, there's a good warmth to it, but you're quite right, it's very zesty, there's a real freshness to it,
yeah.
Which maybe wasn't exactly what I was anticipating.
He's storming away with it, how good is that?
That was a tricky one to eat in one go.
You did it.
Absolutely delicious. Oh. Exactly. So remind me, what's the garnishes on here, Andrew?
So the garnish has some lardo, some smoked pork fat, mm-hmm. and some...
Oh, that's why, that fit me like a glove.
That's because the mushrooms fit you like a glove.
Oh, yeah,
they're called king oyster mushrooms.
Okay.
Yeah, they're beautiful. They're like, they've got an amazing texture where, I don't know, you can try the mushroom by itself. Mm. It has the texture of like abalone, like a seafood.
Yeah. It's like a scallop almost. With
exactly.
Sort of
yeah, yeah. And you can do amazing things with it. You can either slice it and just lightly pick it at that, or you can cut it up into strands. They can almost resemble the texture of noodles.
Yeah, I can imagine. As an overall, it's just absolutely delicious, wonderful.
And Andrew, I'm
looking forward to licking the plate clean.
Andrew, what's next for you as you grow your career? Do you want to open more places? Are you happy where you are? TV calling? What would be next, do you think?
I think most importantly, just getting the restaurant to continually evolve is the most important thing. We started off, I remember, with like only a few handful of people in the kitchen and only a handful of people in front of house just frantically running around. And now we look around, there's like 30 staff. I don't even know if people showed up to work or not nowadays. So, you know, it's lovely to build this family together and the restaurant's full. We're very, very lucky and we've had some positive reviews. But more importantly, if you come in on any dinner server, any lunch service, more than half the dining room will be people who come regularly. I think that's the single fact that I hold on to when I look out into the dining room from the open kitchen. Go, you know what? I know half this dining room, which means that we've done something right.
I think you've done quite a lot right, including feeding up Tom Edwards.
Yeah, definitely two plates, 100% right. Where I'm standing, Andrew, it's been brilliant to speak to you. Thanks for coming.
No, pleasure.
To
Thank you.
Well, there you go, Andrew. The Chinese zest still on the palate?
He's nice, isn't he? And we found out all about Chinese New Year. Well, that's all we have for on this edition, 395 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Helena Jarit. And our studio manager was Claire Urban. The Monocle Weekly is going to be back at the same time next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.